Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Sponsored by Verizon Business Security Solutions, powered by CyberTrust.
Hello and welcome to this special Red Alert Head for the Hills edition of Risky Business, your weekly security podcast available on itradio.com.au and now on searchsecurity.com.au as well. Today's show is a bit special. We'll be unveiling details of a glitch in Microsoft's Windows software you've probably been reading about. Now, before you all go thinking that Risky Business is an unethical publication for releasing details of an unpatched vulnerability in this podcast, there's a few things you should know. Firstly, we've been holding on to those details for a couple of weeks to give Microsoft time to prepare a patch. If that patch isn't out this week, it'll be out next week as part of the Patch Tuesday cycle, I expect. Secondly, the vulnerability was presented to an audience of 200 people at the KiwiCon Hacker Conference in New Zealand a few weeks ago, so the cat's out of the bag already. You can't let it out twice. Thirdly, this thing has actually been exploited very publicly already in 2006, and it looks like there are some people out there doing evil things with it as we speak, so it's best to get it out in the open. And finally, there's actually a workaround for our enterprise listeners, and we'll be cluing you in shortly. We've also published some snort signatures that you can plug into your IDS to see if this thing is actually a problem for you, and a big thanks to Adam Poynton for providing them to us. You can find them on the site linked through from the post for this podcast. Sources within Microsoft also assure us they are providing mitigation information to clients via phone support. If the information that follows in this podcast freaks you out, then by all means, give them a call. Now that ultra-mega-crazy disclaimer is out of the way with, we can tell you all the juicy details. We're talking, of course, about the WPAD vulnerability in Windows. It's not a memory bug or something you exploit in that way per se, but it's a way of tricking workstations into downloading bogus configuration information from a server an attacker has set up. It's got to do with proxy configuration settings. If an attacker can send bad settings to one of your workstations, then they can proxy all of its browser traffic, and that is bad, bad news. And all an attacker has to do to exploit this bug on millions of machines, probably machines in your organization as well, is register a special domain name. And this isn't a joke. We'll have details on that following the news with Manir. We'll also be chatting to James McMahon from Verizon Business Security Solutions in this week's sponsor interview. James will discuss that recent data loss incident in the UK that saw 25 million taxpayer records, including banking information, leaked because of a lost disk. We'll be discussing what that means for centralized data storage and the Australian ID card. But first, as always, we're joined by our friend Manir Katadia, editor at ZDNet Australia, for this week's ZDNet News Headlines. So, Manir, we'll just kick off with this first item now, and Dan Gear, who is a fairly well-known bloke in security circles, has suggested that websites should start offering friendly rootkits.
I don't like the thought of any rootkit at all, really, but yeah, he seems to think that some sites should have a rootkit and that'll help protect the people as they're shopping. I don't know, do you get this at all?
Look, I kind of get what he's on about, but he seems to be, you know, I disagree with his proposal. His proposal is if you go to the bank website or something like that, instead of just using a certificate, you actually run a trusted Trojan, more or less, which encrypts your keystrokes and all of that. So, it's designed to combat keyloggers, basically.
But it's just been, we're just giving up and, you know, saying, well, we're going to have keyloggers, we might as well, you know, live with them rather than try and stop them get on our machines.
Well, you know, I mean, it's a funny little proposition, right? Because basically what you're doing here is conditioning users to execute code on their machines in the name of security, and we know that that will become the social engineer's best friend.
I don't see how you can actually have a friendly rootkit or a rootkit that's a good thing in any way at all. It's just going to allow the bad guys another way to get in, really, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I just don't think that encouraging users to run friendly rootkits is a particularly good idea.
No, nor do I.
Okay, well, look, we'll just gloss over that one and skip to the next item.
Right.
And it seems that Microsoft Office floors are up 300% in 2006-2007. But this is hardly surprising, is it? Because I guess the operating systems have got a little bit harder to exploit, so guys are going for the Excel and Word floors.
Yeah, poor old Microsoft being so popular. I mean, virtually all the attachments that come through, you know, I mean, people send Word files, Excel files, PowerPoint through email all the time, so it's not a surprise that they'd be attacked by the bad guys. I mean, how many times have we seen stories this year about dodgy Word files going through and, you know, taking advantage of 0 days? So they've been patching like crazy, and that just shows. So I guess it's slightly safer now, but I don't think that just because they've gone up 300% and all of these things have been patched that you're actually any safer. I mean, do you reckon this is going to be a big deal for OpenOffice and all the alternatives?
Well, look, if anyone actually used them, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, I don't think OpenOffice is widespread enough to be a target at the moment, much like Mac OS X, even though we've seen some recent activity in that area. But I guess when you're looking at Office flaws, like in Excel and Word, really, we're at the point now where if you're double-clicking on one of those attachments, you may as well be loading an executable. I mean,
yeah, just... pretty much so.
Then again, I mean, it's kind of good that these flaws are coming out because, you know, we've seen patch and fix as a methodology work quite well with software like Microsoft SQL Server. So, you know, we might actually arrive at that point where a lot of the obvious bugs are ironed out and then we just see that steady trickle.
The thing I'm really worried about is that, you know, people, you just get used to these files coming through. People have to open them as part of their work. There's no way of stopping these files and saying, okay, we can't, you know, like with banned executables, pretty much nobody sends them anymore. But you can't ban the Office files at all. So, I mean, maybe this is going to push people towards looking at alternatives like ODF and other things like that.
Yeah, maybe we need some sort of sandboxing tool so that we can open them in a restricted environment or something like that.
Now, who knows, 20 years.
Are you ready? I want to make fun of the Australian newspaper. Do you want to help me make fun of the Australian newspaper? Because they ran on their last Tuesday's IT section on the cover, they ran a story about how Australia's secret, super secret spy agency, the Defence Signals Directorate, was going to make sure that Parliament House's new fandangled wireless system was safe from Chinese hackers.
Yeah. I see it's the guys you see sitting outside with their laptops.
Yeah. So, I mean, what's really funny about this is the Australian report made it out like it was a really big deal that the Defence Signals Directorate was going to actually give the nod to this project. But, of course, the Defence Signals Directorate has to give the nod to these sort of projects. So I guess that's not really much of a story.
No, not really. But
yeah, I mean, the Australian Associated Press wrote up a story which says guarding political secrets from foreign government hackers is the motivation behind a move to set up cyber protection at Canberra's Parliament House. The Defence Signals Directorate will oversee security for a proposed new internet system at Parliament House, News Limited reports. But they oversee all of those projects, so why are they writing
it? It wasn't such a big deal at all.
No, it wasn't. But
and even then, if you pitch it like it's a security thing and we're adding wireless, it just kind of like doesn't really make too much sense either.
No, it doesn't. But I mean, the DSD do their job fairly well, so you know, hopefully they'll be doing all their VPN tunneling and all of that. And,
yeah, well, you'd hope so.
All right, now, this is a little bit interesting, this story, because it comes from CNETnews.com, which is ZDNet Australia's parent site in the United States, and it says that governments have actually begun targeting themselves with phishing attacks in order to highlight weak points in their security.
Yeah, I mean, this is pretty much part of the education process. I mean, they didn't say which agency, but, you know, we've heard about this before, where instead of, like, waiting for some outside phisher to come in and send in and nab your details, instead you send out a phishing email to all your own employees and then see who bites, basically, and then go and beat them up, I assume.
Well, this spear phishing stuff, you and I are exposed to so many new techniques that the vendors peddle as being the latest, greatest hacking technique. And spear phishing is one of those that's been bandied about for quite a long period of time. But it seems that it actually is a bit of a problem. It led directly to that that massive Salesforce.com breach, which caused all sorts of headaches. So, you know, really when people are grabbing, you know, company logos, they look at the way internal company mail is formatted, you know, then they create this really clever bit of social engineering and send it to people, and it works.
It's very, very difficult to defend against that. I mean, you know, we're back to the problems with you sending around Word documents again, or, you know, Office documents. You have to open it. There's no defense against that. And this is the same thing. If you know how a company works and you know what kind of emails are regularly sent and the employee gets it, you know, it's got to be something that sends the alarm bell ringing that makes them stop and not open it. And if you bypass all of that, then I don't see if there's any defense against that at all.
Well, I think what was a little bit more spooky than that, Maneer, is that in the case of the Salesforce.com breach, they actually grabbed a list of client details. And then they used those client details to exploit the client. So Salesforce.com customers started getting emails that looked like Salesforce.com invoices, which of course, being Salesforce.com customers, they would be expecting. So, you know, double click here to open your Salesforce.com invoice. And of course, the people, it's going to the right person in the accounts department. And it's an invoice that they're expecting. So of course, they're going to double click on that because, you know, these spearfishers are taking advantage of pre-existing trusted relationships. So yeah, I this stuff is a lot more serious than I thought it was going to be, you know, because it's really low technical sophistication in these sort of attacks, but they're very sneaky.
Yeah, exactly. It's a very, very worrying development and something which I don't quite know how we're going to get over. I'm looking for the security companies to come up with something here, but I don't see what they can do. They really, really can't.
No, it's exploiting bugs in wetware, which is the, the little mushy thing between our ears. But I think the funniest thing about this CNETnews.com story is they say, one federal agency has taken the step of sending out benign versions of a phishing attack. Just very interesting that they don't actually say which federal agency in the United States did this.
No, they have kept that bit quiet.
They have. Okay, on to the next item. Now, we discussed this last week, that massive UK data breach in which 25 million bank account details from the UK tax service wound up being sort of left in the back of a taxi or something like that in clear text form. What's interesting here is that it's prompted some political debate over whether or not the proposed UK national ID card should go ahead.
Yeah, that's right, and too right too. I mean, you know, I'm surprised it took something like this for them to think, oh, well, maybe we can lose some of this information. It's like, for God's sake, get a grip. What's going to happen over here now? Do you reckon we're paying attention to that?
Well, look, I really hope so, you know, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens with this new... with this new government. I mean, Stephen Conroy, I think he's got the communications portfolio. I'm not sure if that includes tech. So he's going to have to get his head around this stuff. They were taking a lot of policy advice from the young bloke who cracked the government's anti-porn filter.
Yeah, that's right.
So it seems they're prepared to listen, but I really hope they're looking at these headlines and taking a bit of notice. I think Labor is opposed to the national ID card, but of course, now they're in government, who knows what's going to happen?
Well, exactly, yeah. I'm not sure, but I'm not confident that we're not going to get it, and God knows what we won't be able to call it next year.
Yeah, but yeah, maybe putting everyone's identity information in a single repository isn't such a good idea when, you know, data breaches like this can occur. So one to keep an eye on, and definitely a story we've been covering and following on Risky Business, and one we're going to keep following.
Yeah, better believe it.
Some of the biggest cybercrime news over the last couple of months is that New Zealand police this week swooped on an alleged botnet ringleader.
Yeah, this guy was only like 18 or 19 or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, what I believe has happened is they've gone and raided him, taken him in for questioning. I don't think he's been charged yet, but his handle is Akil, one word. And it looks like he's been caught up in part of a bigger sting. Some other reports have suggested that his role in this botnet scam was actually just creating the software, and he's actually been selling off the software to other people who've been using it to conduct fraud. So it looks like he is really one of those guys in the back room of a much bigger operation. In our final news item, Munir, MI5, that wonderful federal organisation in the UK, has warned businesses of Chinese cyber spying.
MI5 has actually said, yeah, there are some real issues here, and they're definitely pointing their finger at the Chinese.
Yeah, and one of the blokes here at KPMG told Silicon.com, which is another site which is part of the CNET and ZDNet network, that MI5, through its branch, the Center for Protection of National Infrastructure, has been monitoring activity emanating from China, and it's noticed an upsurge in electronic espionage attempts. The Director General of MI5 sent 1,000 letters to the heads of UK businesses, warning them that spies are targeting financial information relating to deals which may occur and involve Chinese companies. So I imagine that's around the bargaining of large services contracts, or in the case of Australia, it would be, you know, commodities contracts. I imagine they would love to be reading the mail of... you know, companies like BHP and Rio Tinto.
Yeah, no, totally. Can you imagine what it feels like, though, when you get a letter from the MI5 saying the Chinese are trying to hack you? I mean, how much of an effect do you think this is going to have?
But it's very cool for us who've been following IT security for years and years and years, because we've been jumping up and down since 2000 saying that this stuff's important, and now it is.
Yeah, we're right again.
And, yeah, it's funny. The MI5 refused to comment on what it said was leaked correspondence.
Oh, great.
So, you know, fancy that, a secretive organisation being secretive.
Yeah.
Okay, mate. Well, thanks a lot for coming on the show again, and we'll chat to you again next week.
That was great. I look forward to it.
That was ZDNet Australia's Munir Kataria with this week's news headlines. And you can read all of those stories by going to zdnet.com.au. Now it's time for this week's much-hyped feature story. As regular listeners would know, a few weeks ago I jetted off to windy Wellington to attend the KiwiCon Hacker Conference in New Zealand. I wanted to go and socialise, learn a few things, and basically just get the hell out of town for a few days. I didn't think I'd be up to my ears in cutting-edge shit for the whole weekend, which was a nice surprise. By far the most interesting presentation, to me anyway, was Bo Butler's talk on the so-called WPAD vulnerability in Windows. This bug has been around forever and was first supposedly fixed in 1999. Then again in 2005. Well, apparently that fix didn't work either. The bug is in the way Windows automatically configures its proxy settings. WPAD stands for Web Proxy Auto Discovery. And when it works properly, it's really quite handy. In short, when you fire up Internet Explorer, it'll check a WPAD subdomain for proxy information. So wpad.riskybusiness.melbourne.itradio.com.au could be a good example. If it can't find a WPAD box there, then it'll step up a hop to wpad.melbourne.itradio.com.au. Failing that, wpad.itradio.com.au, then, and this is the bug, it'll go to wpad.com.au. Now, as you'd know, this isn't an IT radio subdomain, it's a bloody domain name. That means that the owner of wpad.co.uk, for example, can put a config file at that domain that millions of machines will download. The owner of that domain can act as a proxy between the victims and the internet, load their browser with malware, and basically do whatever they want to the hapless victim. This bug used to see browsers in the US hitting wpad.com, but apparently MS did a bug fix that solves the problem for North American computers. Here's Butler explaining the problem during his presentation in Wellington a few weeks ago.
The DNS searcher that they built into this thing is like a monkey. It climbs the tree, it climbs the DNS tree until it gets what it wants. And then like a monkey, it'll keep climbing and climbing long after it should stop. So if your DNS suffix given to you by your DHCP server is my department, my division, mycorp.com, it tacks WPAD on the front and tries to get a file from that address. If that fails, it goes up one. If that fails, it goes up one. If that fails, it goes up one. Not so good. I talked to the WPAD.com guy. Asked him about, how many lawsuits and so on and so forth, what his stats were like and stuff like that. This is what you get if you go here. Notice the cool spelling of discovery. So, I had a chat to him, and he received some interesting complaints. I mean, the big problem is, he's not doing anything to anyone. He's just got a domain name with a web server sitting on it, and he's serving out stuff. Yeah, for a few years now, he's had really no complaints at all. 5 complaints, last one in 2005. Reason being, Microsoft patched the DNS monkey, as I call it, in 2005. They patched it in this really crappy way. They counted the number of dots and they said, well, let's stop with one. So it doesn't go to wpad.com anymore. It gets as far as wpad.mycorp.com. I mean, that's great, right? Yay for America. Not so yay for other countries. There was a guy in co.uk. He registered wpad.co.uk, switched on a proxy, pointed people at it, and directed the whole country to a auction site for a couple of months. And there was a big uproar about that, and it was a big issue. But that was years ago. You'd think they would have fixed it, but they haven't.
Butler, having registered wpad.co.nz, realised he was onto something pretty big. He also had a tense moment when the server he'd put up at that address threw a disk and went offline. But you should keep in mind, he wasn't actually offering configuration information or man-in-the-middling anyone. He was just seeing how many clients would actually hit his box and try to download the config information.
This was when my Kodo box threw a disk. Which is a bit of a painstaking moment, because I didn't at that point know what happened to computers when they asked for WPAD and got an address and then couldn't go anywhere. I didn't know if they'd get tarpeted, so I'm like, ooh shit, am I tarpeting all of New Zealand? Like, massive, massive bad karma, it was suck really bad, so I was like freaking out in the colo, reinstalling Debian and so on and so forth.
Well, at least he can laugh about that now. The most unbelievable thing in all of this is that Internet Explorer 7 is affected by the bug, even running on Vista. As Butler explained while going through some pie charts showing which user agents connected to wpad.co.nz. But it's not just Internet Explorer 7, it's Winamp, it's software updating agents. Many, many software products are affected by this bug.
MSI 6.0, 6.2 million hits. MSI 7, 3.1 million hits. CF Network 18511, so I'm thinking that's probably Safari. Firefox 2.0.0.6, 7, 4. NS Player, which is the, you know, the browser built into Winamp. That thing's a major culprit. It's all through here. And other. And if we jump into the other, various update agents, NS Player, Casper Sky, so on and so forth. Outlook, Gran Paradiso, which is, I think, the new Firefox 3 thingy. So those are all the user agents.
Of course, the biggest threat is to Microsoft's browser software. So did Butler try to notify them?
I sent them an email, well, a couple of emails, but they ignored me pretty much the same as they ignored the other guy that talked to Microsoft about it.
Now, as it turns out, after a few conversations I've had with Bo, he'd sent his advisory to security@microsoft.com, and that's the wrong address. It's for Microsoft's physical security department. Even so, that mailbox is supposed to forward information security-related mail to secure@microsoft.com, the correct address. I've spoken to some sources at Microsoft, who didn't want to be named, about what went wrong, and at this stage they're drawing a blank. It could have been that someone saw it was about WPAD and assumed Butler was talking about a fixed issue. Maybe the message never got forwarded. Who knows? Butler has told me since that he never thought Microsoft would actually take the issue seriously. After all, it was exploited in spectacular fashion in the UK last year. Why would they care now? Well, they do, and now they're frantically working on a fix. So it's a big whoops on behalf of Bo Butler. But there is some good news. Here in this part of his presentation, Butler explains how you can mitigate the effect of this vulnerability. And considering it affects non-Microsoft products as well, even after a patch comes out, you'd probably do well to implement some of these mitigation strategies.
In terms of fixing this, what do you do to fix it? First off, the best method is to give the monkey what it wants. In your organization, or if you're working for an ISP and your ISP's DNS policy or something like that, make WPAD.whatever. If you've got a bunch of customers, make WPAD.whatever they get. Point it at something harmless, have it return a proxy file that just says return direct, and you'll be fine. You can set up the DHCP option 252, but that works with a lot less things.
In addition to the steps Butler just outlined, you can download some snort intrusion detection signatures from itradio.com.au. If you have an IDS that supports snort signatures, load them up and see if you can spot any outgoing DNS lookups for WPAD domains. The signatures are linked to from the post that contains this podcast, Risky Business Number 41. And you can also download Butler's slides from that main post. Luckily, Butler is one of the good guys. The closest he came to doing anything evil was making sure it worked. One guy asked Butler if he considered goatseeing half of New Zealand. As you'll hear now, he talks about all of the evil stuff he could have done but didn't.
From a moral standpoint, have you considered that you could goatsee half of New Zealand?
Indeed I have. I mean, I have OrganNet as well. I've stayed far, far away from the government mill. I mean, I consider myself a pretty karmic person. Like, I tend to try to... But the real deal here is I saw in my logs, you know, I did reverse resolves, and there were a bunch of lawyer companies there, and I was like, yeah, I like my asshole being small. And, Well, I do have a Python script that I could target IPs if I wanted to, or you know, so on and so forth. I did actually, I will confess this. I did actually just before the presentation last night in my hotel room, 2 a.m, finally grow enough balls to switch it on for 5 minutes, and because I didn't know what I'd get, I didn't know if you know it all gets filtered off or what. But I switched it on for 5 minutes and gave a valid WPAD file to about 10 people, and ooh crap. People were going to, like, there were guys going to Google, there were guys going to Flickr, and then there were guys trying to Google for why isn't my networking, and so on. It was pretty amusing. One Here's the thing. My friend Darren suggested that I have a mock auction for the domain name to see how much people would be willing to pay for it.
Well, that's probably a bit.
Okay, well, thanks. And I think it's beer time.
That was Beau Butler's KiwiCon presentation on the WPAD bug. You'll be seeing an advisory from Microsoft on that one any day now. Okay, well now it's time for this week's sponsor interview. And this week we're talking again to James McMahon, a professional services manager who works for Verizon Business, the company that has sponsored this podcast all throughout 2007. Bless. I spoke to James about the proposed national ID card in light of that massive data breach in the UK. Is it a bad idea for us to aggregate all these government databases into a single repository?
There are a lot of databases that our governments have out there already. The tax office has their database, Centrelink has their database, DVA have their database, and I'm sure I'm getting some of these names wrong now that we've got a new government. This information is there in a lot of places already. I think very few people are probably going to argue the toss that the governments are going to share some of this information, and whether or not they always have a need to or just are sharing it, it's a moot point. If we're sharing this information and people from one government department are accessing it in another place, in another government department, there's a mechanism there that people could lose data regardless.
You think it doesn't really make a great deal of difference whether or not these massive databases are aggregated or not? You're not a subscriber to the belief that putting all your eggs in one basket is a bad idea?
Well, it certainly makes a damn big target, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Where, and with a big target means a big consequence if something does go wrong. But we've seen from the UK system, things can go wrong already. Mm. Now, who's to say an electronic system for transferring that or for having that data access in the UK, while it may present a bigger target in some other areas for dedicated fraud for people actually attacking it, it may also produce a reduced set of risks. So it may provide a reduced set of risks for people who to prevent against the accidental transmission.
So you think there's some benefits here that are perhaps being ignored in some of the media coverage?
Yeah. So the media coverage is focused on the privacy talk. And the Privacy Foundation have got some valid concerns. If all of this information is in one place, then a malicious person or someone who's curious, who happens to work on the tax department, and as we saw from Centrelink 6 or so months ago, there are a lot of people who got let go all of a sudden because they'd been inappropriately accessing data. Mm. So this happens all the time, and we know it happens. But there are a lot of controls that you can put around electronically, some data like this, to actually protect that.
But, I mean, isn't the case in this instance that the consequence of the consequences of such a massive aggregated database being pwned by some nasty, evil Russian would be so incredibly dire that it could actually present a genuine threat to our systems of commerce?
I think that there are the databases out there already that if one of these was cloned now, we're already possibly in that area.
So you think it's kind of too late to be worrying about aggregating the data? The fact that it's stored in so many central repositories in government already means that, you know, we better just really focus on locking it down.
That's a really key point. The authentication that needs to go around access to this data is absolutely crucial. One of the interesting things that have come into some of the international systems that have already been implemented, if you look at the Belgium identity card, which has had some interesting press at different times about its privacy, one of the features of that is that an individual owner of an identity card can use that card, log on to an online system and see exactly who is accessing their data, which means that you can see who's watching you, which really is a big disincentive for someone sitting at Centrelink or at whatever government department to take that cash to provide whatever information they're being requested.
So detailed audit logs can sort of combat the human element of this type of data leakage?
Particularly when they're publicly available. Mm. Most of these systems have audit logs that have most of the functions that we need. So they're non-reputable, they're accurate, they're non-tamperable, and we can see exactly what's happening to these systems. But if you take it to the next level and actually make that audit data public, so I can see when Joe Blow is accessing information about James McMahon, and if I'm thinking, hang on, that's not real fair. Mm. Now, I'm sure a lot of our government departments and our public servants would be sitting there and cringing in fear at hearing that, and yeah. Not because they're maliciously accessing data, but because how do you control that when someone is being investigated for tax fraud? And I don't know if I've got a good answer for that right now, but it is an interesting answer for the privacy side of the argument.
Don't you think that Verizon Business Security Solutions might have a little bit of a vested interest in talking up the advantages of this identity card? Because I'd imagine that you guys would be one of the obvious candidates who'd go to tender on this.
Sure, I'll admit that. The access card or the identity card, whichever one you want to call it at the moment in Australia, it probably doesn't matter. It was out for tender and it was something that we were interested in, as were a lot of other integrators. How it is at the moment is going to change. It's definitely going to change. So the access card, as we knew it, is dead. It's certainly going to change with the new government. And yes, in something that goes on, we would be interested in tendering. But I think as a global, as a possibility for good governments later on and around the world, I think that putting these sorts of controls is something that's good for all citizens, not just as a corporate.
That was James McMahon from our sponsor, Verizon Business Security Solutions, rounding out this edition of Risky Business. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast via iTunes, RSS subscription, or email updates. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Oh, and here's what happened when I asked the coffee girl at KiwiCon what she thought of making pick-me-ups for 200 hackers on her weekend. She thought it was cool. She got to find out how a fringe group lives. Catch you next week.
Have a good time, meet some interesting people, find out what another sector of society is doing that you've got no idea about.
Funny, I was reading a story before I came over here. Actually, on the plane coming over here, about the Finks motorcycle gang.
The what?
The Finks. And they have these tattoos saying 1%, which is they're the 1% fringe, you know? And I figured, what if you got the hackers and the Finks together? You could have motorcycle gang hackers.
Yeah, you could do that. You could do that. Would they be riding Harleys or scooters?
Just a little too damn straight. Now that we're free to communicate, and we're all